This morning, our teaching text is going to be read by Aiden, and let us tune our ears to this beautiful text.
A reading from Matthew 5, verse 7. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. The word of the Lord.
Good morning, everyone. It has really been wonderful for me to be here at Mars Hill this weekend. Lisa and I had a really memorable time hanging out with about 60 couples talking about how to thrive as a family this weekend. And just like AJ said, really touching to see people really going deep into some conversations, talking about how they can pursue the best for their family. And I'd like to say I brought the good weather this weekend from San Francisco, so you can thank me for that. Make sure you get outside this afternoon before the rain comes. I have spent the last couple years getting broken open by the Beatitudes. And I'm excited that I get a chance this morning to invite you to reflect a little bit on one of them in particular. I got to say, before we get into the topic, though, I'm going to invite you to take a few risks with me this morning. We're going to spend a little time doing something a bit reflective and contemplative. I'm going to ask you to get up and move around and do something with some other people during the teaching this morning. And I am probably going to ask you to commit to promise, make a promise with me to do something this week. So are you up for it? You okay? Okay, wait a second. I saw some shaking like this. All right, let's hopefully more of this. Because I realized if I just come up and tell you all kinds of fabulous stories and wow you with the ideas I have, that's not enough to bring us to a place of transformation. We've got to get in on this together, and that requires your participation in this. Let me reflect for a moment just on the Beatitudes in general. The signs of haunting are all around us. Conflict rages between groups and nations. The gap widens between the poor and the rich. And due to our actions, the future of the planet is threatened. If we're not disturbed by that, then we haven't been paying attention. What's disturbing you these days? What's waking you up? Charlottesville, Las Vegas, Puerto Rico? What is it that is the Spirit inviting you to wake up? What if the Beatitudes are the keys to our liberation? These ancient sayings spoken by Jesus offer us a radical alternative to the broken systems we've created. And I think in them we hear the whispers of another world. Blessed are the poor, those who mourn. Blessed are the meek, those hungry for justice, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, the persecuted, and Jesus said, blessed are you. These nine beats name some illusions that have held us captive. And this morning, we're going to look at one of those. These nine beats invite us towards what is most real and true. These nine beats invite us into a new way of life. And it's not just for the powerful, for the privileged, or for the most pious. This is a way we can actually walk together, nine beats to the bar. So the beatitude we're at in this series is references what I would like to call the way of compassion. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. It's been a big week in the news as far as mercy's been concerned. Around our dinner table this week, the big topic was hashtag Me Too. Anybody else familiar with kind of the conversation going on about this? A very high-profile Hollywood executive has been indicted on all kinds of charges of sexual abuse and assault. And it's amazing the number of women who have come forward, and many of them everyday names for you and I. So the I think what's heightened the story for me is the number of friends that I have who have posted their Me Too stories on places like Facebook and Twitter. And that so many of my my family and my friends have come forward to speak the truth and say, I've in my life been a victim of sexual trauma and coercion, catcalling, propositioning in ways that I did not consent to. And I thought I should just be quiet about it. And that really broke my heart. So my heart of compassion and mercy was awakened to go out to so many people that I know. My second response to the story was to look at this human being with disdain and disgust, judgment towards this person who must be much more evil than I am. And then to sort of pat myself on the back and be like, well, I've never done anything like that. I'm a human being that's respectful towards other human beings, not like that guy. But if I sat with it a little bit more, and some of my daughter and some other friends of mine had kind of brought this to light to me, I've participated in a culture, been complicit in creating an environment where in recent history and for a very long time in human history, we've created a culture in which this kind of behavior is so prevalent. And so I had to go a little bit deeper and say, where do I need mercy on this? When have I participated or listened to a joke that was disrespectful? Or looked at a person in a way that was disrespectful and objectifying? Or not spoken up when I see other people make statements or treat somebody in a way that is dishonoring to them? So a lot of complicated sort of things come up when we think about this, that I think touch on this topic of mercy. And so this morning, I think for us to get anywhere close to really knowing what Jesus was inviting us into with this beatitude, we need to do a little bit of self-reflection. And probably the circumstances of our lives and the things that we experience help awaken us to the ways that we need mercy and the ways that we're invited to show mercy to others. Sometimes for me, it's been painful stories that have awakened me to this. When I was in my late teens, early 20s, I quit college. I moved to inner city Minneapolis to work at an inner city mission. And I felt like it was God's call on my life. And I really loved hanging out with these at-risk kids and families. And the most bizarre thing happened to me while I was working there. I was assaulted verbally and physically by the person who was in charge of that gospel mission. And it was humiliating. And I walked around for years telling everybody I knew about how much this person had hurt me. It was really close to me. Anytime I had the chance, I would be at somebody's house and I would start venting about this painful experience that I had. It seemed so unjust. And I spent a lot of time living in that space of woundedness. Another thing that awakened me to my need for mercy and the invitation to show mercy. My son and I once, we had a habit of going on dates when he was younger on Saturday mornings. We would go to a really great French pastry shop called Tartine. If you ever visit San Francisco, there's a couple who's going next week. You got to go to Tartine. Really great croissants. So we're finishing up our breakfast, our coffee and our pastries, and my wife Lisa texts and says, Mark, you guys need to come home now. And she said, there's a dead body in the yard next to ours. So we sprint home, and our house is taped off with that police tape, and we crawl under it and walk up the stairs, and our neighbors are standing around in our living room looking out the window. And there's a 19-year-old young man laying face down in the concrete. And I'm talking to the police and we're trying to figure out why he's there, and we're crawling around on roofs, and did he fall off a roof, or was this a drug overdose? And I stood there in my living room looking out the window, and my heart broke with compassion for this young man. What's happened? Why did he die? And the CSI people were working, taking their photos and marking things up. And eventually they rolled over his body. And I saw his face. And I'm embarrassed to say it, but the first thing I thought was gangster. He had the clothes of like the Latin gangs in our neighborhood. And I realized that this person that I'd been looking at, thinking I was compassionate, had been a person that I'd walked by 100 times on the sidewalk. And every time I did, I would look at him with disdain. And I thought, man, my compassion has come too late. Maybe he wouldn't even be laying on this concrete if I'd been the kind of person that when I looked at him with eyes of compassion rather than disdain. We struggle to figure out what to do with the painful experiences in our lives, and how to forgive. Somebody this morning even told me, I feel I love this invitation towards mercy, but I don't think I'll ever be able to forgive my father for what he did to our family and other people I love. I'd like you to take a moment and spend some time reflecting on these two questions. I'm going to give you about 2 minutes to do this, to just sit quietly and consider. For what in your life do you need mercy? And then also consider the question, who do you struggle to forgive or to have mercy towards, to stop looking in judgment and look with compassion towards? Take a couple of minutes, and maybe it helps you just to close your eyes and silently reflect on those two questions. I want to see if you're with me right now. So you've had a few minutes to reflect on this. I just want to ask you a couple of questions and give me some feedback. Anybody out there like me who has struggled in their life to look at people and not judge them, to stop judging? Anybody else besides me? All right, you're with me. Anybody else out there who struggled to forgive somebody that's hurt you? All right, great. So what I hope to do this morning in the time that we have together is figure out together how we could move from that posture of judgment and that posture of resentment into a better place that this beatitude invites us into. Couple things about judgment and resentment. That's the opposite of mercy. I'm not being merciful if I'm judging or feeling resentful. I think that judging and resenting can frustrate our relationships. It taxes our energy. It takes a lot of energy to be resentful and to judge. And it actually stresses our bodies. I like to call this the ugh in my stomach. When somebody that has hurt me comes into the room, or I see him walk into a restaurant, suddenly my stomach clenches up. Have you ever had this situation happen to you? Or if their name comes up in conversation, I feel a tightening in the chest. And I'm tempted to immediately want to say something critical about them if they're brought up in conversation. For some of us, the effects of resentment play out maybe in their heads. We get headaches or feel it in the back of our head. Others of us, we carry it in our back. And so there's a cost for us to live in that posture of judgment and resentment. Good question for us to ask is, how's that working out for us? Is it yielding good results in our lives? Or what I think this beatitude invites us to is to imagine the possibility of a life free of judgment and resentment. What would that be like? Would you like to have a life where you were free from that the ugh in the stomach and from having to carry that resentment around, that mood of judging? Anybody else besides me? I see some nods out there. So it might help us to explore a little bit, why is it that we tend towards judgment and resentment? And I have a couple thoughts on that. One is, we really want the world to be fair and to be just. We kind of start making these connections when we're young. If I do this, this happens as a result. And I think it's the most primitive way that human beings tend to think. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, tit for tat. It's why we love the most mainstream Hollywood films, because most of them reinforce our hopes that people get what they deserve, and that the good are rewarded and that the bad are punished. And we're waiting for that in those 96 minutes of the film. When is it all going to resolve so that everybody gets what they deserve? And to be fair, I think this is part of how we develop our moral compass. I remember watching movies with my kids when they were small. My daughter's first film was The Lion King. And it led to lots of conversations afterwards, because we saw some really good and noble characters. And then there was this character named Scar who was really bad. And I remember Haley really thinking, I want to be like those good characters. I don't want to be like that bad character. So it's helpful for us to figure out how to divide the world in that way. But beyond that, I think, if we go a little deeper, it could be that we struggle with judgment and resentment because we believe that we have to be part of punishing others or punishing ourselves. Sometimes the hardest person to forgive is yourself. So when we think about this tit for tat, eye for eye, another way of saying this is karma way of seeing the world. Would we want to live in a world where everybody gets exactly what they deserve? No breaks for anybody. Imagine how this would work in a relationship, like in a marriage or between family members. If we run those relationships only on the basis of consequences. If you empty the garbage, I'll wash the dishes. Since you were late to dinner, this is how you get punished. How would you like to be in a marriage relationship like that, or in a child-parent relationship where it's all tit for tat? And so we tend to think this way, but that's not the only way the world works. There is something beyond tit for tat, something beyond karma. And what I want to suggest is that what this beatitude invites us into is the reality that mercy triumphs over judgment. Mercy trumps, and grace trump karma, promising us kindness that goes beyond the consequences of our actions or the retribution we might feel that others deserve. So we have this tendency to think in tit for tat, but the gospel invites us into a deeper reality where we are really going to find our rest and our home and our flourishing. Healthy relationships are based on grace rather than tit for tat. I remember when my first child was born, our daughter Haley, and when I held her in my arms, I felt a depth of love I didn't even know existed for her. You parents here, do you remember that feeling you had holding your first child? Maybe you felt that at your first love as well, or you think about that in the presence of a grandparent or an aunt or uncle. You just cherish and delight in this other being. And it was a sad day for me when I started to see that even though I looked on my daughter with those eyes of delight, she started to think that we were in a game of tit for tat. I remember when she was very young, she would draw me pictures, and they would usually just be sort of scribbles, and she would like excitedly hand them to me, and I did like any good parent, and I wouldn't ask what it was. I would just say, "You use lots of green." And I loved that picture because she made it for me, the one I delight in. But as she got a little older, she started getting frustrated with her drawings. They weren't looking like she thought they should. And so she'd start drawing me a picture, and then she'd crumple it up and throw it in the garbage basket. And I would see 8, 10, 15 little balled up pieces of paper in there because she wasn't getting it right. But what she missed is that it was never about how good she could draw. It was about our relationship. And I want to suggest to you that the Creator relates to us, not in tit for tat, not in performance, but like a healthy parent who simply delights in this child, in their child. Before Jesus had done anything of public significance, a voice comes at his baptism and says, "This is my son, whom I love. With him, I'm well pleased." I've tried to take on those words for myself, and sometimes early in the morning I'll go for a walk, and I'll see if I can really resonate with those words. I am your child. You love me. With me, you're well pleased. So the first two I can kind of get my head around. I start to choke on the third statement. With me, you are well pleased. What if your relationship with your Maker isn't based on you measuring up? I believe the truest thing about you is not that you are broken or that you are flawed, but that you are beloved. Psychologist Kelly McGonigal, who does research at Stanford, suggests to us that even though we have this impulse to judge and measure ourselves harshly, that impulse doesn't actually help us do good things. That it actually stops us from choosing to do the good because it weighs us down. We have to believe in the goodness that's deeper than our brokenness or our flaws. Jesus embodied this. And there's several examples in the Gospels that point to how he looked at people. And so this is the first of three practices I want to invite you to participate in this morning. Is that maybe we could learn to look and see differently. Rather than looking with eyes of judgment or eyes of resentment, to look with eyes of compassion. So notice this. Three examples from the Gospels about how Jesus looked. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion. When the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her. Jesus looked at him, and he loved him. You and I can, I think, learn to resonate with the Creator's heart for ourselves and for others. Okay, this is where it's gonna get awkward and uncomfortable because I'm gonna invite you to do something. I would like you to stand up right now. I'm serious, stand up. And I want you to invite you into a practice of compassion. Let's pay attention to how we see. First of all, look around the room for just a second. There's a lot of people in this room, all different shapes and sizes. Let's try and look, and as we look, try and look people right in the eye as you look around the room. See if you can catch somebody's eye. You might have to, I have to do this sometimes, is when I first look at somebody, I start going, okay, how old are they? Are they attractive or unattractive? Are they like me, not like me? And to look with compassion, we have to jump over those first impulses to stereotype and keep looking until we can see, oh my goodness, look at who I'm looking at. This is a beloved child of the Creator of the universe. Okay, now I'm going to invite you to do something even more awkward. I want you to make the shape of a heart with your hands, and I want you to turn to one person very close to you. And silently hold that heart up and look at them right in the eyes. Okay? Try and do it very quietly, very meditatively. Okay, now you're getting past the awkwardness and the giggles. And I want you to look at them. Oh, we have a whole group right here who's not looking at anybody, so I'm going to look at you guys. I want you to look at them and remember who they are. Scripture says the person you are looking at is made in the divine image, fearfully and wonderfully made, a creature of infinite dignity and worth. I want you to look at them like that and just hold the gaze and see them for who they really are. This could be a sacred moment, so let's try and pause and just gaze. The person you're looking at is called beloved. As you're looking into their eyes, silently whisper, "Beloved child of God, may you be well." Okay, it's awkward. Keep your hands up. Keep looking. Now I want you to consider that the person you've been looking at, thinking, "Beloved child of God, may you be well," has been looking at you thinking of the same thing. What is it like to be held with such a loving and compassionate gaze? All right, you can put your hands down and return to your seats. You guys were good sports about that. C.S. Lewis said it something like this: you have never encountered, there are no ordinary people. You've never talked to a mere mortal. It's a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest, most interesting person you can talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship. I want to invite you to try this sometime this week. Go for a walk at the mall or go downtown Grand Rapids. You could even do it on your commute. And try to intentionally look people in the eye and do the practice that we tried together. I sometimes try this as I'm walking around the city I live in, and it really transforms my posture and attitude towards people. Like I already told you, my first instinct is often to evaluate and judge, but if I'm taking on this practice, I jump beyond it and I get to see this amazing belovedness. Every time I walk by a person, it becomes a devotional act. Try it on and see what you think. Okay, a second practice I want to invite you to try this week that might help us move from judgment and resentment to mercy and grace is this. It's about how we talk with and about one another. I use my body to express resentment and bitterness and judgment. And sometimes formation starts and transformation starts in the heart and moves outward. Sometimes if we take on a commitment of what we'll do in our bodies, it trickles back to the heart. So here's my challenge to you this week. What if you and I, for the next 7 days, made a serious promise not to say anything negative or critical about another human being? How might that change and transform our interactions with people and even how we feel in our bodies? I took on this practice a few years ago for 40 days, and I told my wife and I told my kids, and It really made a difference in my general posture to life. So I'm going to actually ask you if you're willing to make this promise, okay? If you would be willing to join me in this experiment, you can give me a thumbs up or two thumbs up, and here's the promise. I promise to practice positive speech. For the next 7 days, I will only speak words of compassion and affirmation about myself and others and avoid making critical and disparaging comments. Anybody in with me? Let's see what happens as we make this promise to practice positive speech for the next 7 days. Some of you are here with people that you live with. Yeah, I like that tapping each other. Yep, we're in it together. And so you can be a real help to the other person that you live with who's here with you by being like, remember that promise we made? Let's try that again. All right? We need each other to be formed. So a third practice that helps us live in mercy is about how we remember. Most of us have experienced some kind of deep disappointment. Someone close to us really failed us and hurt us. And we are in the process of letting go of that. And so I want to invite you this week into the practice of letting go. I love this quote. I've seen it a lot of different places, and there's lots of different versions of it. But it goes something like this. Resentment is like drinking poison and waiting for somebody else to die. So I'm all spun up and I'm frustrated, and when this person comes to mind, I think about the ways that they've wronged me, and I want to see them punished for what they did. I want things made right. And when we do that, we're the only ones affected by it. And it's helpful to ask the question, what is the benefit of hanging on to that resentment? Would I be willing to just let it go? So a couple things I need to clean up about what forgiveness, or clarify about what forgiveness is and is not. Forgiving someone does not mean denying or stuffing down deep pain that you've experienced. That person really did hurt you, and it doesn't help to just put a Band-Aid over it and pretend it didn't happen. Forgiveness also doesn't imply condoning hurtful behavior or saying it doesn't matter, it wasn't wrong. It was, and it hurt you badly. Forgiveness, though, this is an interesting one, isn't contingent on the other person admitting they were wrong. Sometimes we wait to get over our resentment until we think, I'll finally forgive dad or mom or my ex when they admit all the ways that they hurt me. We're not promised that we get that. We can forgive them whether or not they ever see or can acknowledge the ways that they've hurt us. But here's something also important to clarify, that forgiving someone is not the same as trusting them or feeling safe with them again. Reconciliation is another step, and it requires a person admitting they're wrong, making some amends, and time to rebuild trust. Does that make sense? So if someone has really hurt you and it's not even safe for you to be around them, you can forgive them without entering back into a trusting relationship. So just in the last couple years, I was hurt in a way I'd never imagined that I would. And so I've had to work through more of a process of facing forgiveness than I really ever have in my life before. And some things that have helped me that might help you. It helped to kind of think that there's some steps in this process, that forgiveness isn't a one-time thing. Every time I remember the hurt, I have to make the choice to forgive again. And so I think the first step is to really face the pain, to sit with the feelings. It's helped me to journal. It's sometimes helped me to talk with one or two trusted friends or guides about the depth of the pain and disappointment that happened. And then a step for me was to consent to what I would say is consent to the law of cause and effect. Here's what I mean by that. The person who hurts you or who has a pattern of hurting other people, things are not going well for them in their life. They're not going to be rewarded for continuing the kind of behavior that hurt you. So there's natural consequences that they're going to experience. You don't have to be in the place of being the punisher for somebody else. A third thing that has helped me is to try and understand, what are the events and circumstances that led this person to treat me in the way that they did? If we dig deep, most of us can say, yep, I saw that mom or dad, they had early childhood trauma. They might even had an organic mental illness or chemical imbalance. There are some reasons why it doesn't justify it, but it explains some of why they had an inability to treat me in the way that I feel like I deserve to be treated. We can practice this if maybe the person that you struggle the most to forgive is yourself, to also practice some self-compassion. I had limits, and I was maxed out, and I need to be gentle with myself and understand what led me to be to the things that I feel badly about. Then I found it helps to view the situation from a larger perspective. Most of us experience wounds in our lives, but we have the choice about how we deal with those wounds. And I want to suggest to you that we make a choice to either transmit the pain that we experienced, meaning we let it eat at us and we let it infect the relationships around us, or we have the choice to see it transformed. And one thing that helps me with this is to realize that all of our lives are part of a larger cosmic struggle. That the things I face, I can either cast my vote to see hurt and pain magnified in the world, or I can choose to see it transformed so I don't spread any more of it, so I break the cycle. Which one do I want to do? Do I want to see more of what I've experienced or less of what I've experienced? A very practical discipline for me about this is to pray for and bless those who have hurt or cursed me. So I've actually grabbed pictures from Facebook from the folks who have hurt me over the years, and every morning for 7 days or 14 days, when I'm really feeling like I'm struggling with this, I'll post their picture in a file, and I'll one by one look at those people that I struggle to forgive. And I'll try and think about their life situation. I'll try and see it from that bigger perspective. And then I'll actually look at them and pray a prayer. May you find peace, embrace goodness and love, and experience what's real and true. And what I've found is I can't keep living in resentment with them while I'm praying for God's blessing in their life. So if there's somebody that you think you can never forgive, maybe this is a practice that might help you get the freedom to really live in this way of compassion. Martin Luther King Jr., civil rights activist, I learned a few years ago that the reason he got involved in the civil rights movement is it came out of a trauma. In the mid-50s, someone threw a bomb through the window of their home and threatened the lives of his wife and his child. And he realized, I have a choice right now to let this eat at me and destroy me, or to transform it and to forgive. And it led him later on reflecting on that moment of when somebody bombed his house and tried to kill him and his family. He said, our goal is to create a beloved community, and this will require a qualitative change in our souls as well as a quantitative change in our lives. So we live in a culture of tit for tat, eye for eye, and tooth for tooth, and it is making the whole world blind. But this beatitude invites us into this radical alternative called the way of mercy, that more than anyone, Jesus embodied when he's hanging on the cross And he looks down at the people taunting him, trading his clothes, and mocking him as he's being executed. And he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." So as we come to the table this morning, I want you to come in a posture of the heart, realizing that when we come to Christ and we come to this table, that Christ is seeing you and I through eyes of mercy and compassion. And if we can really embrace that and own that and live out of it, it's going to reflect in how we treat others as well, to know that we are the beloved. So we'll begin to approach the table now. Kyle, come on up and lead us.